From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, in for Marty Moscowane. As the 2012 presidential campaign rolls on, the U.S. Supreme Court is poised to make some decisions that will have an enormous impact, not only on the election, but on Congress and on all three branches of government. In the next few months, the court will wade into such political minefields as Arizona's immigration law and President Obama's signature health care reform law, and then there are matters of criminal procedure, privacy, decency on the airwaves, and much more. So here to help us understand the significance of this particular term and what it could mean for the presidential election, for Congress, the government, and for the rest of us, we have Lisa McElroy. Lisa is associate professor at Drexel University's Earl Mack School of Law, where she specializes in the Supreme Court and constitutional law. Lisa, welcome to Radio Times.
Thanks, Tracy. Thanks.
So this term blockbuster is being used quite a bit to describe this term, and we just talked about. I mean, there are a lot of things going on. Why is this term so significant for the Supreme Court?
Well, one thing is that for Supreme Court watchers like me, and I should start the show by saying I am a Supreme Court junkie. I love this the way my husband's going to love the Super Bowl this weekend, you know? But for people like us, the last couple of terms, and when we say the term, we're talking about basically the year that the Supreme Court covers, the last couple of terms have been really kind of dry and a little bit boring. And this term, we've gotten such great stuff. We have these political cases, like you mentioned, the healthcare cases that we're all so excited to see. We have this immigration case. We have cases involving church and state and the First Amendment. Yeah. And these are the kinds of issues that not only drive people like me, where I follow the court every day, but everyday Americans can really see this case matters to me too. Yeah. It affects my life directly. Yeah. And I think that's why so many of us are thinking, what an interesting term. Only drawback, I guess, is we'd love to have cameras in the courtroom to be recording all of it.
Well, yes, and we want to talk about that because, in fact, just today in the New York Times, there's an editorial in support of that. What is the court's rationale for not wanting to have cameras?
The court has a number of reasons that they say we're at least not ready for this. And you need to know that the court is a very slow-moving body. They're very tradition-bound. They're very reluctant to change. And they really want to be unanimous on this point. When they do decide to have cameras in, they want to be all in. Mm. But a couple of the things they say is that they're afraid that it would somehow undermine the public's confidence in the court, that if people could watch them doing their work. Now, I'm not saying I agree with this argument, Tracy, but if somehow people could watch them doing it, that somehow they wouldn't believe in the legitimacy of the court so much. The justices also love their anonymity. They love being able to walk through D.C. or even through the court building without anybody knowing who they are. Mm. Chief Justice Roberts tells a wonderful story from when he was clerking for then Associate Justice Rehnquist. And if you picture, you take your family to D.C., you're in front of the Supreme Court, you want a picture. So what do? You say to somebody passing by, could you take a picture of my family? And the chief says that dozens of families have no idea that in their photo albums is a picture taken by the chief or then Associate Justice Rehnquist because he happened to be walking by. Hey, you in the cap, could you take the picture?
Your average looking individual.
That's right. And then they say they have security concerns, that if people were to see them and know what they look like, then they could be more at risk. And we do know that they get many threats at the court. I'm not buying that one so much either because, you know, they've been on TV an awful lot lately. Larry King, Colbert, they're writing books. They're out there. So the court has a lot of reasons that they use, but I think most of us, including the New York Times, thinks that there would be so much more benefit to the American public in seeing what the court does.
Well, I want to come back to that, Lisa, because there is more to say about that, and especially as it relates to health care reform, which they'll be taking up, and I think we want to tie those things together.
Sure.
So interesting that all of this just happens to be happening in a presidential election year.
Sure.
Is that by design, or how does the court decide what cases it's going to take? Is it by design that they're tackling these huge cases in a very political year? Is it coincidental? How does that work?
Well, it's a little bit of both, Tracy. So the first thing that has to happen is that a case has to work its way through the lower courts through a very complicated procedural system before the Supreme Court even has the option to say, yeah, we want that. And then when it comes to them through a process called certiorari, it's an appeals process where you say, hey, court, we've got this really important issue of federal law here, and we'd like you to take a look at it. Mm-hmm. The court then will take a very close look, and they get about 8,000 to 9,000 petitions a year. So lots of cases to choose from.
Wow.
But 4 justices out of the 9 have to say, yes, we think that this is an important enough issue for us to take a look at as a whole court. And it's pretty hard to do that. If you think about it, they hear about 75 cases per term. And with those 9,000 petitions, we're talking about less than 1%, fewer than 1% of the cases. But then why do the justices take what they take?
Yeah.
I'd love to have a crystal ball and be able to tell you. You know, it's kind of like, will the groundhog come out and see his shadow? We never really know, right? And we've got indicators. You know, Punxsutawney Phil, he wiggles his little nose. But we don't really know. What we do know is that the timeline worked really well to get these cases here. And you're right. It does coincide really nicely with this election year. So it's anybody's guess what will be happening.
Well, we want to take some time and really talk in detail about some of the cases coming up. Immigration law is a big one.
Sure.
Healthcare reform is a really big one.
Yeah.
There are a number of those that will be coming up in the spring. Also, some really interesting ones that have already been decided that have implications in all kinds of different directions. And I'd like you to help us unpack a couple of those. One took place in Texas.
Yes.
There was a case about redistricting, drawing new maps for voters.
Right.
And tell us about that and why that matters and why it was so significant.
Well, as we know, the way that voting districts are drawn are going to be based on a number of factors. And what's happened in Texas is that the Hispanic population in Texas has really, really increased recently since the last time that maps were drawn. And so it was up to the legislature to figure out how should we draw these maps to be fair in encompassing this new population. And under the Voting Rights Act, what the Voting Rights Act says, and it's a federal law, is that if there are new districting plans in a place that has traditionally been a place that discriminated, those districting plans have to be approved. Mm-hmm. And they have to be approved either by the Federal Justice Department, the Department of Justice, or by a federal court that sits in D.C. So here was the problem. The legislature drew these plans, and what happened was that some people in Texas said, hold on a minute, these don't seem fair. They seem to be discriminating against Hispanic voters. So they went to a court in Texas instead, while they were waiting on the D.C. court to say, so D.C. court hasn't acted yet, primaries coming up, oh my gosh, we got to rush, you know, not enough time. And so the Texas court said, well, hold on a minute. We're going to redo this. We're going to redo the maps. Well, now the Republicans in Texas are mad, right? Because we don't want these maps redone. We're pretty happy with the way they were. So they said to the Supreme Court, we need you to jump in. This process was wrong. The court shouldn't have done it. And the court very quickly agreed to do that. The Supreme Court came back in January, right away heard these cases, and very, very quickly issued its opinions 11 days later. And they said, you know what? You can't just disregard what the legislature said, court, right? You have to at least give some deference where what the legislature did makes sense. Yeah. You don't get to just start over.
Well, and it matters, too, because we're talking about a number of potential congressional seats there, correct?
Exactly. I think it's 4 congressional seats. Right. So this is a very big deal, and it's a very big deal on both sides of the coin, both to Republicans and to Democrats. Yeah. And it's a big deal because we do know that where the Supreme Court sort of jumps in and tries to do something fast, it can be a little trickier on whether we like that result. The wonderful Dahlia Lithwick, who is a Supreme Court reporter for Slate, likened it to a Lamborghini, right? A Lamborghini trying to rush in versus that Volvo that's just nice and
steady.
Safe and steady, right? So we saw this with Bush v. Gore. We saw the problem. You know, they did it fast, and a lot of people said, I'm not so sure about that. So we'll be waiting to see how these redistricting cases in Texas turn out.
And Lisa, one last question about that. What is taking the Washington panel so long?
Who knows? Right?
Because that would seem to me to be the obvious question. If, right. if they were sort of in the end approving or disapproving or calling the shots, what in the world makes that process, you know, take so long?
Well, there could be any number of factors. It could be their docket. It could be that there's disagreement among the judges on the panel. Lots of different things could be playing a part.
Yeah. Another interesting case about separation of church and state, interesting case regarding the Hosanna-Tabor Church and the EEOC. Tell us about that.
I love this case, Tracy, because I think this is a case that shows us that the Supreme Court deals with things all the time that affect regular people, people just like you and me. And so this case was about a teacher in a Lutheran school. And the teacher had been teaching there for some time. She taught ordinary subjects, you know, math, English, to elementary school students. And she developed a condition. She developed narcolepsy. And eventually she needed to go out on a medical leave because she was ill. So she went out on medical leave, and when the doctor cleared her to come back, she called her school and she said, "Great news, I'm doing better. Doctor says I'm ready to go." And the school said, "Well, actually, we don't want you back." And she said, "Well, you can't do that, right? Because under the Americans with Disabilities Act, I am protected and you can't discriminate against me on the basis of my disability." And the school said, well, actually, we don't have to follow that because we're a church school. And because you were a teacher, they called her a called teacher. She did do a little bit of religion instruction, just a little bit every day. And they said, we are allowed to decide who we want to serve as ministers in our school or in our church. We don't think you fit the bill, and so we don't have to have you back. And the Supreme Court agreed. The Supreme Court said that there is this thing called a ministerial exception. The ministerial exception says that where there are people who impart the faith, who serve as ministers, and I should say the court wasn't completely clear about what a minister was, right? To some extent, the church is going to help us figure out what a minister is, but that they can decide and they don't have to obey employment discrimination laws. It's very interesting stuff.
And was there also a piece of that, Lisa, about concern that if the federal government gets involved, that then it may determine who can be a minister, what their message can be, and maybe that message is not consistent with what that particular church or denomination is trying to teach. Was there concern about that as well?
Sure. Well, I mean, we've seen this for many years. For example, in the Catholic Church, we know that only men are priests. Now, typically, you couldn't discriminate against women because that would violate federal law, right? But here, there's this special exception, this special carve-out. And in the opinion, Chief Justice Roberts did point out that, first of all, no one spends all of their time doing religious duties, even if you're a Catholic priest or a nun or something. You're going to spend some of your time out in the garden, maybe, doing things for the church, right? But that churches do need to have some leeway to decide who can convey their message of faith. And the only thing that the concurrence said, where judges agreed but didn't completely agree, was wouldn't it be nice to know a little bit more, to have a little bit stronger definition of what legally is a minister?
Yeah.
But for now, that's all we know.
Well, we have so much more to talk about. We invite your questions and comments, your questions about how the Supreme Court works in some of these big cases that are coming up. 888-477-9499 is the number to call. Lisa McElroy is our guest. And we'll be back right after this.
Open Connections, a progressive educational environment, supports WHYY. At Open Connections, youth ages 4 through 18 attend programs 1 to 3 days a week from September to June. Guided by their principles of respect, freedom, responsibility, and natural learning, Open Connection serves as a community base for young people and their families seeking an innovative, collaborative, and process-conscious educational environment. An open house at their campus in Newtown Square is Sunday, February 12th at 4 p.m. Details at openconnections.org.
I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. This is the winter membership campaign here at WHYY. We remind you several times a year that if you listen to WHYY, take that next step and become a supporter. We have an ambitious goal, 8,000 pledges, and we can make that goal if you make that call at 1-888-345-9499, or you can pledge online at WHYY.org. Think of what you get on programs like Radio Times, in-depth interviews about local, national, and international news issues, and events that matter to you. We also introduce you to interesting people and ideas. We believe that you're the kind of person who is curious about the world we live in. We also know it takes a lot of work to keep up on everything. So we do your homework for you. We track down guests, invite your phone calls to create a lively and informative conversation. You don't hear that on the radio every day. Make a call right now at 1-888-345-9499 or pledge online at WHYY.org. Thanks so much.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane. We're talking about the Supreme Court and what a big term this is for them. Some really huge decisions that have far-reaching implications. Our guest is Lisa McElroy, who is associate professor at Drexel University's Earl Mack School of Law. She specializes in the Supreme Court and in constitutional law. And Lisa, as we were discussing, lots of big cases, and there are, and we've been talking about some that have already been decided, but there are some yet to be decided that are enormous, Arizona immigration law being one of them.
Absolutely. Yeah. So Arizona has really been quite aggressive on the immigration front. And last term, the court decided a case in which employers would get in trouble. They could lose their business licenses if they didn't verify the immigration status of their employees. But this term, we've got this case about police stopping people who they might reasonably suspect are undocumented immigrants. And the big thing that we're thinking about here with Arizona is that we've got an issue between who gets to decide, who gets to make the law in the immigration realm. And we typically think of immigration as being something that the federal government does, right? And we've got, you know, an agency that deals particularly with this. And yet Arizona and some other states, we should say, have been pretty aggressive in saying, you know what, we don't think the federal government is doing enough to protect our citizens, to protect our state from these people coming in. And so we're going to make some of our own laws. So as we said at the beginning of the hour, Tracy, the Supreme Court is going to step in when they see some big issue of federal law. And what they see here with this Arizona immigration law is maybe the states are overstepping what they should be doing. Maybe this is something that should be left to the federal government. Or maybe, like in the case from last term with the business licenses, they'll say, it's okay, Arizona, go ahead.
Yeah. Really interesting, too, because as I recall, there are some other states now that the administration has sued for similar reasons, correct?
That's right.
They have enacted their own or attempted to enact their own immigration laws.
That's right. So several states have gotten in on this game. And that's why, and this is very typical with the Supreme Court, when the court decides this case, it's not only going to affect the state of Arizona. It is also going to have a wide ripple effect. And other states that are attempting to put these kinds of laws into place are going to have to take another look at their law and say, does this fit within what the Supreme Court just addressed?
Yeah. So the Obama administration is taking issue with several points of Arizona's law, specifically, like you mentioned, stopping people and determining their immigration status. I think there was a provision about people carrying their papers with them.
Correct. All the time.
Those kinds of things. And on the grounds that it was an invasion of privacy, or what was the administration's argument that Arizona had gone too far with this?
Well, the big thing, again, is that can Arizona really take on this task of putting immigration laws into effect where this might be an area that really is the federal domain, where the federal government has control over it, that we can handle it at the federal level, and that the states in trying to step in are encroaching on the federal territory? Right. You know, every time I think about this case, I think about that photo that's been circulating. I know a bunch of my Facebook friends have posted it, and it's of the governor of Arizona, Jan Brewer, and she's putting her finger in President Obama's face. And people are like, wow, that takes some chutzpah, right? And people are sort of saying the same thing here, that, wow, Arizona, I don't know if you remember when these laws first hit the news, but people had some deep concerns about whether Arizona was being really discriminatory and whether Arizona should be going here. Should they even be going here?
Going down this road.
Right, exactly.
And I guess Arizona's argument is, hey, you're in Washington, you're not dealing with what we're dealing with here at the border. We're the ones who are, you know, in the trenches with this. And so, you know, we need to protect ourselves however we can.
That's exactly right. The legislative process is not working for us. The agency process is not working for us. You're not doing enough. Maybe you're just too far away. You know, we hear all this stuff about Washington insiders versus outsiders. We got to do what we got to do.
Yeah. That one is certainly going to be huge in terms of its implications for the presidential election, too.
Sure,
right?
Absolutely.
I mean, what could we see happening depending on which way this thing goes?
Well, it becomes an election issue, doesn't it? So in the states, like Arizona, like some of those other border states that are dealing with a lot of these immigration issues, it becomes an election issue for both for President Obama and for whoever becomes the Republican nominee. What do you think about these laws? How could federal government be doing a better job to protect us?
Yeah. Do you have any sense, Lisa, of how the court might go or what some of the points are that they might bring up just based on what you've seen them do, some of the decisions that they've made thus far? Any sense of how that could go?
Well, I mean, the first thing that we know is that Justice Kagan is recused. Mm-hmm. And recused means that she has agreed to step out of it, partially because this was all being dealt with within the Obama administration when she was Solicitor General, when she was the main lawyer before the Supreme Court for the U.S. government. So what we have now is a potential 4-4 split. And when you have a 4-4 split, we just leave it with what the lower court said. But in the business licenses case from last term out of Arizona, we did have a 5-3 decision. Justice Kennedy, whom we know to be the swing vote in so many of these cases, did give his vote to the conservative wing, and they said that you can revoke these business licenses. So we may see a similar outcome. The other three justices, though, the liberal wing, said federal law controls. Arizona, get out of here.
Wow. We want to talk about health care because that is another huge one. And certainly it's President Obama's signature legislation. It was something that he worked very, very hard to get through. And now that is coming up before the court. And let me just, before we get into that, invite our listeners to join us and give you the number. It's 888-477-9499. We're talking with Lisa McElroy. She is a law professor at Drexel, talking about the Supreme Court's term. And this one just is really above and beyond what many other terms have been in terms of the significance of the cases that are before the court, both some that they have decided already and some of those that are yet to be decided, Lisa, like healthcare reform.
Wow.
Huge, right?
Huge. Yeah. So we knew this was coming, right? We knew this was coming. Several lower courts had spoken to it. And one of the times when we know the Supreme Court is very likely to take a case is when several of the lower federal courts have spoken and they've given different decisions. If we think about it, Tracy, when we have federal law, we want that to be consistent across the entire United States. So if, for example, the geographic district, the circuit near Baltimore says something different than the Atlanta court, the Supreme Court is going to step in and say, let's resolve this. Let's tell you what federal law really is. So that's what's going on with the health care law. And once we had this decision from Atlanta saying that it was unconstitutional, the Obama administration said, let's skip some steps, right? Let's go straight to the Supreme Court and see if we can get the Supreme Court to hear this case and hopefully put the stamp on it that the law is a good law.
And the issue really is the part of it that says people must be required to buy health insurance. Is that sort of the big point of contention?
Well, there are several points of contention. I think that most people are really focusing on that one big part. So we have the individual mandate that says that by, I think it's 2014, people have to buy health insurance or else you will be taxed if you don't, right? And so some people are saying, the challengers are saying, you can't do that. You can't force us, that this exceeds Congress's power under what we call the Commerce Clause about how we do business, interstate business, that this exceeds Congress's power, and you can't force people to do this. So that's a really big piece of it, is whether Congress has the power to say, you have to buy health insurance.
Well, there's also an interesting point where the court, from what I read, may end up not deciding this because there is some injunction, there's some very, very old law that says, hey, you know, if we interpret this as a tax, there's an old law that says you can't do that before the law is even enacted. You'd have to wait until after it's in place. Explain how that works and the possibility maybe that the court would end up saying, you know what, we'll set it aside till 2015.
Sure. So the Fourth Circuit, so this is another geographical district, said that a problem that we have here is that a plaintiff who comes into federal court has to have what we call standing. Standing essentially means that they have suffered harm, right? Mm-hmm. And that harm has to have either already happened or it has to be imminent. And the problem is that it's not imminent. We're talking about 2014, maybe even 2015 here, before anyone would be harmed. So what some people are saying, and the court's going to look at this question, is that we need to wait until somebody refuses to buy the health insurance and then they get taxed and then they can go to court and complain, I shouldn't have been taxed. Yeah. And so the court has allocated a good amount of time. It's so interesting, Tracy, because listeners may know that the Supreme Court typically gives 1 hour of oral argument, 1 hour for the parties to flesh out what are very important cases. And here they've given 5.5 hours. It's 3 days of argument in March. It's a huge deal. Yeah. They're seeing this as a hugely significant case, and that's going to be just one of the issues addressed.
Yeah. And how important is this going to be, Lisa, to the Obama administration? I mean, this is something that the president worked very hard to get through. So what does this mean for him in an election year?
Oh, it's huge. Because if the Supreme Court says, oh, no, President Obama, you and your folks went too far, you can't do this, then really, some of the achievements, you know, I killed bin Laden, but then we also have the healthcare law. Look at what I did. And now he can't say that anymore, right? And in fact, it could even be a little bit of egg on his face. Mm. Now, I will say one thing. The fact that the court took the 11th Circuit case, right? The 11th Circuit said it's unconstitutional. Several other courts had spoken to this as well, but had said it was okay. And so one thing we know, and this makes sense, I think, is that where the Supreme Court agrees to hear a case, very often, the majority of the time, it's because they're going to reverse the lower court. They're going to say to the lower court, no, you got it wrong. Because that's really when they need to step in, right? That's not 100%.
Yeah.
Doesn't work all the time. But the vast majority of cases, it does happen that way. So it may give us a little clue of which way the court might be going with this.
If it is struck down, Lisa, what could that mean in terms of just healthcare as we know it, or as we're about to know it, if it goes through?
Well, it means that Obama or whoever the next president is goes back to the drawing board. And we really need to see how much they strike down. One of the issues before the court is, let's say the individual mandate is unconstitutional. Can we cut that piece out of the law? Because, of course, the law is very large. I mean, it's very, very big.
It's like 975 pages.
It's insane. Right? I have to say, I have not read the whole thing, Tracy, right?
You haven't read it?
No, no. So one of the things that we're thinking about is, can we cut the bruise out of the apple? So if the individual mandate were bad, can we still let the rest of it stand? And that's going to be one of the questions the court's going to be looking at. So it may not totally decimate it, although this is sort of the central piece of it, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is huge.
Yes.
And this is why, Lisa, so many people are interested in seeing how the Supreme Court tackles this, which circles us back to cameras in the courtroom, doesn't
it? Oh, yeah. Oh, me too. So if you think about it, particularly with this case, wouldn't cameras be great? Because I think this case captures the American imagination in a way that so many other cases may not. This is seventh grade social studies. You know, I have a seventh grader, and they learn checks and balances, and they learn we've got the executive branch and the legislative branch and the judicial branch. So we have the executive branch, signature legislation. We have Congress that passed the law. Mm-hmm. And we have the judicial branch that is stepping in. And so we really see the government at work, and how fascinating it would be if we could see it.
Yeah. Well, Lisa, tell us a little bit about what it's like. I mean, you actually have been there. And I think so many of us are curious as to how the Supreme Court works, what happens in that chamber, what are the discussions like. Give us a feel for that, because we've not been able to see it, really.
Well, the first thing I think that most people say when they go, and I take a group of Drexel students there every year, and the first thing they always say to me is, it's much smaller than I thought it would be. I think we picture this giant coliseum, you know, we could see the Patriots play. But no, it's only about 250 seats. And when they built it to where you would always be looking up. And so the bench is up, and up around the top of the court, there's all kinds of beautiful artwork. This came up in the FCC case because one of the advocates pointed out that there were some bare bottoms in the art. Maybe we'll talk about that in a few minutes.
Yes.
But the justices come out from behind a curtain, You hear the clerk say, "Oye, oye," and then they all come out as one from behind a velvet curtain, and they sit down, they have their black robes on, and they become a court. Instead of individuals, we see this vision, we see this montage of these people who have come together to make very important decisions. Yeah. It's really majestic. It's magnificent.
You know, I'm wondering, you said earlier that one of the concerns that the court had about having cameras in the courtroom was that it might undermine the perception of the court. And I suspect that there are people who think that it might do exactly the opposite. That
oh, absolutely.
If these proceedings are made public, that people might, in fact, have greater respect for the court.
Including, believe it or not, Justice Kagan. She gave a speech last summer where she said, "I never have gotten this argument. All of my colleagues are so smart, and they're doing such important work, and they're so well prepared."
Yeah.
And it really is true. However you feel ideologically about some of them, these are the brilliant legal minds in our country. And how wonderful it would be for people to be able to see how seriously they take their job and how important these cases are. I also think it would give people a vision of, like we said before, that regular person coming to the court and bringing an important issue.
Yeah.
Someone like the teacher at the Lutheran school, or like Lily Ledbetter from a few years ago, who was the victim of employment discrimination.
Yeah.
Right?
So for all the ceremony and all the pomp and circumstance, it really does. They're making decisions that hit us all right where we live.
That's exactly
And I think that's
right.
what people would like to be able to see. Is there any chance that anytime soon we might actually be able to watch the proceedings, or not so much?
If it happens in my lifetime, I'll be wildly excited.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm not thinking so. They move so slowly. They like things the way they are.
Yeah.
They have no motivation to change. Now, I will say there have been bills before Congress every year for the last several years. There's one right now to force the Supreme Court to do this. And now that brings up the debate of, should the court get to decide?
Well,
or should
exactly.
Congress tell them? And if Congress tells them, does the court have to say, "Okay, Congress, we'll do what you say"?
Well, that raises some interesting questions about who makes that decision ultimately,
sure.
right?
Yeah, and the court definitely wants that decision to be theirs.
Yeah.
You know, Harry Blackmun used to have so much fun. I'm not sure fun's the right word, but he used to really enjoy the fact that he could go to anti-abortion rallies. Of course, Harry Blackmun wrote the opinion in Roe v. Wade. He could go and sort of watch what was going on at these rallies, and no one had any idea it was him.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, we've got about a minute to go, Lisa, and I do want to talk about the FCC versus Fox, because you hinted at that just a moment ago. Also, an interesting case for the court, and we'll get started. If we don't finish, we'll pick it up after the break, but tell us about that.
So this is a case involving indecency on the airwaves, and it has to do with the broadcast media, so regular network television and radio. And of course, we all know about the fleeting expletives, right? George Carlin had that fabulous routine about the words you can't say on TV or radio. And I promise you, I'm not going to say any of them right now, at least not intentionally. But the question being whether these regulations are fair and whether they're constitutional and whether the broadcast media should be held to different standards from, for example, cable and satellite providers.
Mm-hmm.
So it's very interesting, has a lot to do with the concept of safe harbor for children that came up a lot at the argument. So we'll talk some more about it.
Absolutely. We are going to take a short break. We welcome your input. The number is 888-477-9499. You're listening to Radio Times. We're talking about the Supreme Court and some very, very big decisions that they are facing on Radio Times.
Penn Medicine supports WHYY. Doctors at Penn's Depression Research Unit have been studying the causes and treatment of mood disorders since 1964 and are currently performing research to develop improved treatments. Symptoms may include mood swings, low energy, and low motivation. Initial evaluations are offered to determine those who are eligible for treatment. More about Penn's Depression Research Unit at 215-662-3462. 215-662-3462.
I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We have an ambitious goal for the winter membership campaign here at WHYY. We need to hear from 8,000 listeners who want to be supporters, members of WHYY. You are one of those 8,000. You're listening to Radio Times, and we thank you for that. Now take that next step. Pick up the phone and make a pledge of support right now. That phone number is 1-888-345-9499. You can also pledge online at whyy.org. Why do we want you to do that? Because we depend on listeners just like you for about half of our budget. Our job is to provide good conversations about the important issues of the day, and there is a lot to talk about these days. We also introduce you to interesting people and ideas. We have the time on Radio Times to get beyond the headlines and to go deeper than the sound bites. Pick up that phone, 1-888-345-9499. Pledge online at whyy.org. Thanks so much.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moss-Cohen, talking about the Supreme Court and some of the big, big decisions that they're making in an election year that have lots of implications for really all three branches of government, certainly for the presidential campaign. Talking with Lisa McElroy. She's a law professor at Drexel. She specializes in this stuff and has a wonderful knack for boiling it down so that all the rest of us can understand what's happening there. Lisa, we left off talking about the FCC. FCC versus Fox case in particular, but some interesting questions for broadcasters coming up.
Sure. So this is a fascinating case that's actually been to the Supreme Court a couple of times. And this is where the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, I guess you would know, has put into effect, has always had an effect, really, these regulations that say you can't say certain words and you can't show certain things during certain hours. So the idea behind it is that between 6 a.m. and 10 p.m., kids might be watching TV or listening to the radio. I have two kids. I'm familiar with this problem, right? But that we want to have a safe harbor for them where if they happen to be flipping the channels, they're not going to inadvertently come across the F word or some bare buttocks or something like that. The problem has been that, first of all, the FCC has really changed the way it has enforced these regulations. So it went from not being too particular to really getting very strict and imposing very strict fines, even for what we call a fleeting expletive, where it's not planned. You didn't mean for that to be broadcast, but oops, your guest just said that, right? And so ABC and Fox have gone to the Supreme Court and said, look, we've got a couple of problems here. The first problem is there are only a few people who still use these broadcast airwaves, but there are all these cable and satellite providers. They can do anything they want, and you're telling us we can't have this stuff, even if it's inadvertent or even if it's very minor. An example given was an episode of NYPD Blue, where they very briefly showed a woman from the back. She's getting into the shower, right? And interestingly, that show was aired at different times because of time zones. So in some places it was in the safe harbor, in some places it wasn't, and they got fined for it. And so they went to the Supreme Court and they said, look, there are a couple of problems here. First of all, we've really got evolving standards, right? We've really got a society that's very different. Most of the stuff is not coming across the broadcast waves anymore. And these regulations really are unfair to us. They also talked about the fact, and this makes a lot of sense if you think about it, that the market will control for this, that advertisers won't choose to advertise on shows if there are shows that are doing things that they don't like. And so we don't need to worry about this deterioration where everything's going to become, you know, like Jersey Shore or something, right? But the court really needs to think about that, and they need to consider whether it's okay for us to have some different rules for a small segment of the media, and whether there are really good reasons for us to do that.
Well, Lisa, was it one of the justices or someone that I read said, look, broadcast TV is going the way of 8-track tapes.
Yeah, so that was Justice Kagan.
Yeah.
It's not even going to be relevant soon, right? And who cares? On the other hand, the Chief Justice, who has two children the same age as mine, they're 11 and 12, his children, sort of tipped his hand when he said, is there anything wrong with us, I mean the FCC, wanting to preserve, carve out a little safe area for our kids. Oops, right. So, you know, definitely this is something people feel very, very strongly about. Mm. Some of the things that have been pointed out is that if you've got your remote control, you don't necessarily know when you're shifting from broadcast to cable, right? You're just going click, click, click.
Exactly.
One of the very funny things that did happen, and we alluded to it a couple minutes ago during the argument, was that Seth Waxman, who argues very frequently before the court, he used to be the Solicitor General, and he was arguing for ABC, pointed out to the court that, in fact, in their own courtroom, there were bare bottoms. And the justices were like, no, no, they're not. You know, we're all in our robes here. And he said, well, look up. And the art that's around the top of the courtroom, the friezes, they're in the Greco-Roman tradition, and so there are several bare bottoms. Now, Justice Scalia got very excited about this. He wanted it pointed out exactly to where the bare bottoms were. So maybe this is another reason why they'd say we no cameras in the courtroom, right? We'd get those bare bottoms
exactly.
in there.
Exactly. Then you have a whole other set of issues.
Wow.
So it comes down to, well, when is indecent indecent, right?
Right.
I mean, is it indecent in this context, in that context? And may raise some interesting questions for cable as well. I mean, is there a possibility that at some point somebody says, hey, look, you know, cable is allowed to do this, but kids are watching cable. I mean, you've got 11 and 12-year-olds who are watching MTV or VH1 and seeing some things. I mean, is it a possibility that that question could come up at some point?
Well, I think that the FCC only deals with the airwaves.
Okay.
I don't think that they can control the cable and satellite. I'm not totally familiar with their jurisdiction, but it certainly is exactly what you said, that the broadcasters are saying, we need to really understand what we can and can't do. You're being very inconsistent, and we need to have better guidelines.
Yeah. Another interesting case, Lisa, Stolen Valor.
Oh, wow.
About people lying about their military service, lying about awards. And that's one that, you know, the court has been talking about. Tell us about that and how that even came up.
Yeah. So Congress passed this law called the Stolen Valor Act. And I think this really resonates with us on an emotional level, especially in this time of war, mm-hmm. where people are being awarded medals because they've done enormous service for the country, right? Well, this guy who was, he was on a city council or a school board or something, he said publicly that he had been a Marine and he had been shot 16 times and he'd been awarded the Medal of Honor, and it was all a lie.
He wasn't even in the service at all,
no,
right?
No, he had never served a day in the service. And so he got prosecuted under this law for stealing the valor.
Wow.
The idea was that if you put yourself out there as being, you know, someone who's been honored, it diminishes somehow the people who really have been. Now, the issue before the court here is, yes, he lied. It's true. He lied. But just because he lied, does that mean that the First Amendment doesn't protect him? The First Amendment is supposed to protect unpopular speech. So if I come on the radio and I tell you that I'm 29 years old, this is clearly a lie, Tracy. This is clearly a lie. Right.
Hey, I'm 29.
The two of us. Yeah. So, and for a long time, we will be. Can I be prosecuted, right?
Yeah.
Not under the Stolen Valor Act, certainly. But should my false statements be protected?
So are lies protected?
Right.
Right.
And there are different points of view on this.
Yeah.
Now, I think this is a fascinating case to go up to the court, because certainly we feel very, very strongly about lies about whether you served in the military and were a decorated veteran. But we don't feel as strongly about lies that are on Match.com, do we?
Exactly.
And we always think about the slippery slope. We always think about, well, if a false statement isn't protected here, how far will that go?
Yeah.
We worry a lot about that.
That's going to be very, very interesting.
It's fascinating.
It really, really is. Well, you are listening to Radio Times on WHYY, and I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane.
And we hope you will call in to Radio Times with a pledge here at WHYY. I'm Joanne Allen. Dave Davies is here. We're interrupting this very interesting conversation only because we need to in our winter membership campaign. Otherwise, you would hear the rest of the conversation. But because we've got a little bit of business to do, we're going to take some time right now to ask you to join us in our winter membership campaign. The number to call and to show your support for WHYY and Radio Times is, you ready? You want to write it down? 1 888 845-9499. Also, you can call in online at whyy.org. Now, we have some comments here, Dave, and I want to just get them out the way right off because I think a lot of people will probably understand this to the point of saying, wow, that's something I would do. Well, Catherine from Elkins Park says, WHYY is an important part of my day. There was a running joke among me and my friends regarding how often I use the phrase, oh, on the radio today, I heard, dot, dot, dot. And Catherine says, everyone knows instantly that she means NPR and WHYY. She goes on to say, I go to it for information, inspiration, and entertainment. So thank you so much for all the work you do, and please keep it up. Catherine from Elkins Park, thank you for calling in and supporting WHYY and Radio Times. And we will keep it up. But folks, of course, we can only do it with your support, with your financial pledges at 1-888-345-9499. Also online at whyy.org.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, Joanne, to hear someone say how frequently they quote things they hear on the radio. It makes me wonder how ill-informed and uninteresting many of us would be if we didn't have a lot of our spare moments in the car, making dinner, whatever, in which we got the kind of insightful commentary and discussion and analysis and reporting that we kind of, it's easy to take for granted here on WHYY. This morning, you hear Tracy Matisak, who is a veteran journalist. I've known her since the 1980s. We were together at KYW many, many years ago. She was a rising star. And they're exploring in-depth issues that a lot of people are talking about, like for example, the health care law. Will the health care mandate be upheld by the Supreme Court? And what's cool about Radio Times is that it's not an in-and-out. You're going to have somebody settle in, take some time, and get into the guts of the issue, and that's because we let it roll. And I will also note that our fundraising breaks are a little different on this show. We let that conversation wind out for 50 minutes before we take just a little bit of the end of the conversation to join with you in doing some business. Please don't take this very special daily program for granted. It doesn't just happen. It happens because your friends and neighbors over the years have chipped in just what they can afford. Figure out a number. Figure out what you think it's worth to you. Call one of our friendly volunteers. We'll give you some terrific thank you gifts. But the important thing to do now is to make that call, 1-888-345-9499, or, of course, on our secure website at whyy.org.
You know, the Supreme Court has some big decisions to make in this term, especially the health care issue, the health care law issue, that will affect the election possibly in some ways. And also, you know, every time I listen to Radio Times with Marty Moskowain, I sometimes will just sit and just listen. I'm not fidgeting with my phone, I'm not looking at my iPad, I'm not on the computer. I just sit and listen because she and her guests will very often do an extremely good job of delineating the issue so that you understand what the issue is and you can hear both sides in a very civil manner. That's what Radio Times is about, and I'll bet you any money, maybe not $10,000, but I will bet you that that is why you tune in to Radio Times with Marty Moskowain 2, 3, 4, maybe even 5 times a week. Support this programming. Support this particular program. Support Marty Moskowain and her staff and the great work that they do. How do you do it? Well, you make a phone call. It's quite simple. It takes just a few minutes. The number is 1-888-345-9499, or you can pledge online if you're at your computer at whyy.org. We just want to hear from you.
You know, Joanne, this is a part of the fundraiser in which I really appreciate hearing a ping and a ring because you can kind of hit an air pocket. It can be a little down here. A lot of people pitch the first day and the procrastinators all jump in on the last day. But it would really help boost our morale and reassure us that we will meet our goals if in this point when the lines are pretty open, if you could jump in and just take that little bit of responsibility for this institution that matters to you. I'm guessing that you're not the kind of person that would go out to dinner with your friends and then when the check comes, sort of slink off and pretend to get a cell phone call so that somehow you don't pay your share. You wouldn't do that to your friends. Well, if you can afford to support the service and rely on it, and you don't, that's kind of what you're doing. I mean, you're kind of saying, I'm going to let you guys carry me, I mean, because nobody's going to turn off my radio if I don't. Well, we're asking you to think about whether it isn't your responsibility in a time when, you know, when important things are happening in the nation and the region, that we want to do our part to make things right when we can. And if you believe this institution of public radio performs an important role in our civic infrastructure, if it tells you things you need to know, if it enriches your life, step up and take a little responsibility, make a reasonable pledge. You decide what it's going to be. But go ahead and do it now while we need it, while it's quiet, while our volunteers are just waiting for you. The number is 1-888-345-9499. That's 1-888-345-WHYY. Or, of course, on the web at WHYY.org.
You know, Dave, WHYY is all about community. It's the community of listeners out there. It's the community of members. It's the community of folks who work here at the station. Now, if you've been listening to Radio Times and you've been listening to WHYY for a while and you haven't taken the opportunity to join us as a listener supporter of your public media station, well, now is the time for you to rectify that situation. Give us a call at 1-888-345-9499. As I said before, whenever I listen to Radio Times, I can count on the fact that I'm going to learn something new. Tracy Matisak and her guest this morning, Drexel Law Professor Lisa McElroy, were talking about why does the Supreme Court take certain cases? And one of the things that the professor said is that the court will often take cases that it is kind of prepared to strike down the lower court's ruling. Huh, and I thought, well, yeah, of course that makes sense. They're not going to take a case, that they agree with the ruling. They will probably leave time in their court calendar for the year to hear a case that they are probably, not always, but probably will strike down. It's little things like that that you say, oh, wow, I learned that. And then you'll be quoting this at a party or something, and then you'll realize, I did hear that on WHYY. I heard it on public radio. If you have ever done that, if you have ever quoted something you heard on public radio, if you've ever told someone something that you knew about, and in the back of your head you know you heard it on public radio, you're exactly the people who must step up to the plate right now and give us your support. 1-888-345-9499, or you can go online and pledge at WHYY.org.
Yeah, you know, there was a wonderful anecdote that Lisa McElroy told when she was talking about the notion of bringing television cameras into the court, and she was saying how the justices kind of like being anonymous, and she told that lovely story of how justices will sometimes be asked by tourists to hold a camera and take a picture of people in front of the Supreme Court building. And so these folks go home with photos not knowing that the shot was taken by a justice of the Supreme Court. That's the kind of lovely anecdote that you'll often repeat. And it just comes out like dozens of them do here day in and day out. Along